This one lay.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The problem with America can only be resolved by letting that country hold us to ransom. That is the view of Iran's leader when it comes to negotiations between Iran and the West, particularly the U.S. Making those comments in an address to a group of Basij Force members, he also said or pointed to the enormous voice of the nation that rang out earlier this month during pro-government demonstrations, stressing that enemies are trying to dominate minds and influence the world public opinion through spreading lies and fake news. Just some of the topics we'll be covering in this edition of The Spotlight. But first, let me introduce our guests. Kevin Barrett joins us. He's an editor at Veterans Today who joins us from Madison. Also joining us is Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I first start with you, Kevin Barrett. The Iran's leader's address was received and was done at a forum where it consisted of the Basij forces, which are affiliated with the country's Revolutionary Guards. At the same time, they have been at the forefront of dealing with these rioters. And the sacrifice made by them was something that Iran's leader applauded, saying, quote, "You saw in these recent matters that the people of Basij sacrificed themselves to prevent the nation from succumbing to the force of a group of what he called rebels who were illiterate or enslaved people. And they sacrificed themselves to prevent the cruelty of another." The important role that they played is something that is not highlighted in terms of preventing, obviously, these security breaches, to say the least. How do you view that those comments made by Iran's leader on the Basij forces?
Well, this is something that most people in the West don't know anything at all about, and they don't understand that there are many, many millions of people in the Basij forces who are dedicated to upholding the Iranian constitution that makes Iran the world's first Islamic republic. And this group it's got a lot of different facets. It's got social welfare elements. The Basij people are also running educational institutions and doing education and working on all kinds of interesting projects, infrastructure and so on. And then they also are a sort of line of defense of the Islamic Republic. And here in the West, where it's sort of taken for granted in the mainstream media, which is largely dominated by the Zionist enemies of Iran, that Americans are supposed to support some kind of regime change in Iran, it's not understood to what extent that there is this big, well-organized base of support for the ideals of the Islamic Republic. And it's also not really recognized to what extent the relatively marginal forces opposing the Islamic Republic are, in fact, guilty of treason. In the same way that here in the United States, if we had groups that were taking money and weapons from other countries to try to overthrow the Constitution of the United States of America and put an end to the United States as a democratic republican experiment and instead turn us into a monarchy or a dictatorship or what have you, I mean, that would be the highest form of treason. And likewise, these Iranians who are trying to undermine their Islamic Republic are traitors. And fortunately, they're in a small minority. And there's, of course, a broad segment of opinion in Iran that's just people trying to get by in life, just like everywhere else. But the Basij group is really they're the forces, the boots on the ground. They're the popular group that's mobilized in support of the revolution. And they're probably the single biggest impediment in the path of these regime change plans that are coming out of Washington.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what Iran's leader has said regarding the riots, Marcus Papadopoulos. He said some are telling us in the newspapers, on the internet, that in order to put an end to these troubles, all you need to do, which started a few weeks ago, he said all that is needed is to resolve your problem with America and listen to the voice of the nation. But he has come out and also said that negotiating with will not resolve anything, and that resolving our problem with America can only be resolved by letting that country hold us to ransom. That ending statement there is what is being highlighted. What do you think the relevance of that is? What was he trying to say there, Iran's leader?
For the sake of Western audiences, let me say the following. Iran has been maligned, indeed demonized, by America for 43 years because ultimately in 1979, Iranians from all walks of life came together to liberate Iran from the yoke of American and British tyranny, which had, amongst other indignities, plundered Iran's national resources and had violated Iranian cultural and spiritual values. The problem in the West, specifically in America and in Britain, is that people in the aforementioned two countries view Iran through a Western prism, like how they view Israel through a Western prism. When I say to ordinary Westerners in person that Iranian soldiers helped to liberate Christian towns and villages in Syria from the control of either ISIS or Al-Qaeda, these people stare at me gormlessly. Indeed, no different to when I say to the average Westerner that during the conflict in Syria, the Israelis treated wounded Al-Qaeda fighters in Israeli hospitals. Again, the average Westerner whom I say that to looks at me in a gormless manner. So that really is a lesson in human psychology and demonstrates the extent to which the average person in the West has been brainwashed when it comes to Iran. Now, concerning the speech given today by Iran's supreme leader, yes, I agree with him. There is no reason as to why the Iranian government should sit down and negotiate with the Americans. It will not pay any dividends whatsoever. The most important thing for the Iranian government is to do what it has been doing for the last 43 years, developing Iran's economy, providing jobs and homes and salaries and pensions and a welfare state to the Iranian people, and of course increasing Iran's military capacity to protect the Islamic Republic. Other than that, as I said, there is no reason why the Iranian government should sit down with the Americans. After all, the Americans for 43 years have been posing a knife to the throat of the Iranian people.
Well, Iran's leader has said there, Kevin Barrett, that, you know, if we were to look at the negotiations, these riots that have occurred in the country is part of the pressure campaign that the West wants to Iran to compromise on a variety of issues when it comes to the negotiations, and he talked about some of which there are some deadlocked topics. For example, the U.S. wants Iran to abandon its nuclear program, change its constitution, restrict its influence to inside its borders, and to close its defense industries. So you're pretty much stripping a nation out of everything. And he says even if that's done, it's going to keep going into different demands and wanting different concessions from Iran. So pretty much saying that, you know, negotiating with the West is really not appropriate. How do you view that approach by Iran's leader? Do you agree with it?
Yes, I think the leader is right. Just as he was right in the past when he expressed skepticism about the JCPOA when it was being negotiated, he did allow the negotiators to make their best faith effort to reach an agreement, but he never really had faith that that was going to solve the problem. And that viewpoint was borne out by subsequent events after Trump tore up the JCPOA, completely shredded it and violated it. That showed that the leader's skepticism had been warranted. And today, of course, even stronger skepticism is even better warranted. We're seeing this regime change effort against Iran as the West, well, specifically Washington and Tel Aviv, with some help from London, are mobilizing every kind of force they possibly can to attack Iran through every means other than a declared war. You know, they're arming, you know, paid separatists and terrorists. You know, they've already been arming terrorists for a long time. You know, 17,000 Iranians have been murdered by these terrorists, especially the MEK, which is now a fully West-supported, Washington-supported group. But now they've really gone all out. And then these demands, of course, are ridiculous. Obviously, Iran is not going to completely disarm and not have any kinds of relationships with its allies in the region. That's ridiculous. Iran is the largest and, well, it shares with Turkey, I guess, the status of really the largest and most potentially important sort of geopolitical entity in the region. And because Iran is fully independent and sovereign, unlike Turkey, which is still, it's working at it, but it isn't quite there yet, Iran has a huge role to play. And this notion that Iran is going to just fold up its tent and sort of disappear is completely absurd. So the leader is absolutely right. There's no point in negotiating with these lunatics who are mounting this unsuccessful attempt to overthrow your country and overthrow your constitution through violence and terrorism and lies. So you just have to outlast them. And that strategy has worked so far, and it should work even better as we reach the end of the unipolar American empire and the rise of a new multipolar world that Iran will play a very important part in.
Marcus Papadopoulos, you talked about the way that the West views Iranians and Iran as a whole. And also, I believe you touched about that being a result of the way that the media has actually played a hand in that. Now, one thing that really stood out in this media landscape is what happened yesterday when we take a look at the win that Iran's team had against Wales, where you had these Saudi-funded, for example, TV station or a media channel by the name of Iran International, where they were demanding Iranians not to celebrate. They said you should not celebrate. They were telling them what to do, in other words, and that this was wrong, what happened. Of course, critiquing the Iranian soccer players and the team for participating in the World Cup, they even went as far as that. But the mere fact that they're demanding Iranians showed the true face of their, in a sense, as the word or the phrase has been thrown about, sinister plot by them in order to try to nail their version of how things should be. Doesn't that just reveal how low they have come in terms of trying to push their ideologies onto Iranians?
Well, as an overview, football, like other sports, is now in the vanguard of Western foreign policy. The World Cup is being used by the Western ruling elites to push for changes in countries such as Iran, countries which pursue an independent foreign policy and which do not bow down to the diktats of Washington. That is how sad the situation is, that the Western ruling elites have politicized sports. They have politicized the Olympics. Indeed, let me go one step further. The Western ruling elites have weaponized the World Cup, and they have weaponized the Olympics. The BBC football commentators were referring to the Iranian national football team as the, quote, regime's football team. And after the match between Iran and Wales, BBC journalists were attempting to ask political questions to Iranian national football players. Politics and sports, as any level-headed person would know, should be kept absolutely separate. But as I said moments ago, sports is now in the vanguard of Western foreign policy. But if we apply the logic of the BBC, who are attempting to ask political questions to Iranian football players, then why were American sports people and British sports people not asked political questions by the BBC or CNN Sure. or the Daily Telegraph or Channel 4 News about Britain and America's war against Serbia, or Britain and America's invasion of Iraq, Indeed. Or Britain and America's support of terrorists in Syria? Because if you're going to ask Iranian football players such questions, then of course the logic should be applied to British sports people and American sports people. And for the record, I do not believe that British sports people or American sports people should be subjected to political questioning. Indeed. But again, it shows the sheer how low the Western ruling elites have fallen to when it comes to persecuting Iran. And let's be very clear about it. Iran and the Iranian people are being persecuted by the West.
Well, the West is also not covering the news, if they were to be impartial, which they're not, Kevin Barrett, when it comes to an issue like the pro-government rallies that took place. We saw that it was in the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, that showed up when there was, for example, security personnel that were martyred in Isfahan, for example, or when you had the former spy den, as we call it, of the former U.S. embassy, which we refer to as the spying den, of which you saw hundreds of thousands of people, not just showing up here in the capital, but around Iran. Those types of protests where there was a large presence was not covered by the media. In particular, of course, either the Saudi-funded news channel or the state-funded, UK state-funded BBC. Again, this is part of that shaping the image in a different way by the media. How would you rate their efficiency if that was their goal?
I think the Western media has discredited itself to a great extent with its increasingly biased and tendentious coverage of so many issues, including these issues that are of special importance to the Zionist masters of Western media, such as trying to neuter Iran, which is the last major country that's standing up for the Palestinians. And so the Western media already has shot itself in the foot so many times that it lost the power to prevent someone like Donald Trump from becoming president. Now, I'm not a fan of Donald Trump by any means, but it's interesting that he won the U.S. presidency in 2016 by attacking the mainstream media. And the reason that that worked for the first time in American history, prior to that, whenever the media went all out against anybody, they were finished. That happened to so many candidates for so many offices, including presidential offices, but it doesn't work anymore because so many Americans have awakened to the fact that mainstream media is dubious. So by going too far on these kinds of issues, I think that they are undermining their own credibility. And although the sort of rough agreement with these kinds of perspectives that they put out there in these kind of sneaky ways that sort of unconsciously infiltrate the minds of the viewers is it's still somewhat effective in terms of creating a general vague impression of what's going on, what they end up doing is manufacturing support that is proverbially a mile wide but an inch deep. And this coverage of the World Cup and that these, you know, it has been so anti-Islam, right? Hating on Muslim countries that have Muslim values that don't allow for hooligans to get drunk in the streets and beat people up, and that don't allow people to celebrate bizarre sexual and gender ideas. This kind of all-out propaganda that we're seeing, including against Iran, by completely suppressing coverage of these massive demonstrations, mourning the people that have been killed by these terrorists who are trying to overthrow the government of Iran, and on the contrary, on the other side, things grossly exaggerating the people, you know, the size of the group of people that is working against Iran. All this kind of propaganda does in the long run is undermine the credibility of the media itself.
Sure. Israel, as Iran's leader referred to there, Marcus Papadopoulos, the usurper Israeli regime, is something that he said is in line with policies by the West, particularly the U.S., to have domination over the West Asia region in particular. And the question that I have is that has been in overdrive, and it's been like that for quite some time, vilifying Iran, creating Iranophobia, especially within the regional countries. We know that the U.S. has pushed Persian Gulf Arab countries to normalize ties with Israel, and they're vilifying Iran in order to have that unity and include, and for Israel to be part of that. Of course, it's not really been that effective in a matter of speaking, because not all have agreed to it. But do you think that's something that is working or that is not working to the way that they want it to?
Well, Israel is the main conduit for American power in West Asia. So one is not surprised whatsoever that Israel is one of the leading countries in attempting to overthrow the Iranian government and return Iran to how it was prior to 1979, namely a vassal state of the West. But I do believe that Iran is experiencing an increase in attempts by outside forces to weaken it, to subvert it, and to destroy it. And I am of the firm opinion that that is on account of Iran having a strategic partnership with Russia, and also on account of the war in Ukraine. Because the West, via NATO, is waging a proxy war against the Russian Federation. And Iran is a firm supporter of Russia and has shown sympathy for Russia's reasons for having militarily intervened in Ukraine. So it follows, therefore, that the West, in an attempt to weaken Russia in Ukraine, is attempting to weaken Iran at home, with the objective being as follows. If the Iranian government is overthrown and replaced by a pro-Western puppet one in Tehran, then Russia will lose a friend and ally of immense value, which can only weaken its position both at home in Russia and also in Ukraine. Uh-huh. That is why I believe there is an increased effort at present by the West and its regional allies in West Asia, including Israel and Saudi Arabia, to weaken Iran.
Do you agree with that, Barry Grossman?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Kevin absolutely. Barrett. Sorry about that. Kevin Barrett.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's obvious that the U.S. has chosen to try to fight Russia, Iran, and China all at the same time, which from an American imperial perspective probably isn't a very good strategy. Normally, you try to divide and conquer. So we, you know, the American empire should be trying to be friendly with one of those three at least while beating up on the other two, or better yet, be friendly with two while beating up on one. But they're so arrogant that they think that they can attack all three countries at once. And obviously, the Russians, the Chinese, and the Iranians are not interested in being defeated and are going to be working together to prevent any one of them from being defeated. So the U.S. has driven these three critically important centers of resistance to the unipolar hegemonic world order together and turned them into a de facto alliance. And the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, has gotten stronger and stronger. And interestingly, this whole proxy war on Iran that we're seeing now developed. It actually began the day after Iran joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Obviously, that is not a coincidence.
Very well. We're going to leave it there. Thank you very much. Kevin Barrett there, editor at Veterans Today from Madison. Thank you for your contribution. Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author from London. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kavita Tabway and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم فما لنا من شافعين
So now we have no intercessors.
ولا صديق حميم
And not a devoted friend.
فلو أن لنا كرة فنكون من المؤمنين
Then if we only had a return to the world and could be of the believers.
As you were with us previously, dear listeners, we reached the 100th verse of this chapter. Chapter Shu'ara. فَمَا لَنَا مِنْ شَافِعِينَ وَلَا صَدِيقٍ حَمِيمٍ Now then, we have no intercession, nor a single intimate friend. We said that there are some traditions focusing on the importance of intercession and the conditions to reach this level, deserving this intercession. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said about the importance of prayer, Verily, our intercession will not reach those who take the prayer light, and it means that they do not regard it important. Also, the Holy Prophet ﷺ has said, My intercession will not reach the one who takes his prayer light, and by Allah, he will not arrive to me by the fountain of Kawthar. And by Allah, he who drinks liquor is not of me and my followers, and he will not arrive to me by the fountain of Kawthar. Another thing that is highly recommended and is mentioned as one of the conditions of getting this intercession in the other world is a Holy Quran. The Holy Prophet sallallahu has said, "Learn the Quran, because that book will intercede its followers and readers on the day of hereafter." Of course, this is not just merely reading, although it could be, but of course, I assume that kind of reading which is accompanied by understanding and cognizance is worth more being interceded for. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam has said elsewhere, "There are three groups who will intercede unto Allah, the Almighty, the Glorious, and their intercession will be accepted: the prophets, the scholars, and the martyrs." Now, there is also this tradition that the Holy Prophet of Islam, the Messenger of Allah, has said that there are four groups for whom he will intercede on the hereafter day. He mentions the lovers of the Ahlul Bayt and his progeny, those who are the friends of their friends, and those who are the enemies of their enemies. The third group are the ones who provide them what they need, and at last the ones who do their best to undertake one thing of their affairs. Of course, the affairs of the Ahlul Bayt are not the things separated from this religion they have brought us, and the faith they have focused in their traditions. This is the thing that could be done in this role. And that's why in the 102nd verse, these misguided people will say, "Now if we only had a chance of return, فَلَوْ أَنَّ لَنَا كَرَّةً فَنَكُونَ مِنَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ We would be of the believers." That's when they have realized their shortcomings. على مر الزمان تألقا
وأضاء للدنيا طريقا. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Brothers and sisters, we have mentioned many traditions about the importance of intercession and some of its conditions. One of the well-known traditions about this is what Muawiyah ibn Wahab narrates from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. And he says that I asked Imam about this statement of Allah that says, من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه? Who is it that can intercede with him save by his leave? He says that Imam alayhi salam said, we are those who will intercede by Allah's leave on that day. And this is exactly what has been narrated from the other infallible imams. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said, the intercessors are the imams and the veracious ones among the believers. Of course, these traditions that we have read to you in this episode are not in contrast with each other, and they will all mention the different conditions and the ones that can intercede on the day of hereafter. And of course, there is this condition of faith and righteous deeds. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
EU Home Affairs ministers held an emergency meeting on Friday to discuss ways to address a growing refugee crisis. 281,000 people entered the EU seeking asylum in the 12 months to October this year, a 77% increase on the previous 12 months. But the ministers' meeting didn't appear to offer much hope.
We need to protect our external borders, and we need to return those who do not qualify for asylum and to be under the legal umbrella of the European Union.
Rights groups say this approach is scandalous, considering the EU was able to take in 4.3 million Ukrainian refugees within a few months. Regarding refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa, some member states are furious that other EU countries won't help with the numbers.
Unfortunately, the voluntary mechanism will only relocate less than 1% of total arrivals to the European, to the Med 5 countries this year.
One aid worker has told us he witnessed awful conditions for refugees on the Greek Macedonian border.
I spoke to pregnant women who were sleeping on the floor. I spoke to Syrian young man who was trying to get to Europe to find protection with his disabled brother. Thinking of these people and what is being currently discussed, it's actually scary.
2,000 refugees died in the Mediterranean Sea this year as they tried to reach the EU. The bloc is paying billions of euro to countries like Turkey and Libya to prevent asylum seekers from coming here. Earlier this week in the European Parliament, the EU's broken asylum policy was castigated.
For the EU, all refugees except from Ukraine are illegal migrants, and yet most of them come from Afghanistan and Syria, countries that are victims of imperialist interventions and wars that the West caused.
It was suggested in the Parliament that EU authorities are racist, that Ukrainian refugees are welcome simply because of their skin colour. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
...150 universities are involved in 3 days of industrial action, affecting up to 2.5 million students. Action these students support.
If they're not paid properly, they can't teach properly, and therefore we can't learn properly, and then we're not getting what we're paying for in the first place.
Teaching conditions are learning conditions, and as long as our teachers aren't paid well, they can't teach well.
We think it's really important that teachers get a fair pay, and it's important for our learning conditions as well, so we stand in solidarity with our teachers.
The list of grievances is long. Trade unions say staff pay and pensions have declined by 25 and 35% respectively since 2009, in real terms, while workloads have increased. Lecturers earn an average of $55,000 a year. Academics are increasingly being offered short-term contracts, meaning many have to reapply for their jobs every few months.
People who are having to work more than one job in order to stay alive because the jobs that they get are casualized, their contracts are not secured, and the salaries they get for each job they do isn't sufficient to keep them alive. We've had stories up and down the country of people who, for example, have to live in a tent because they can't afford to pay the rent on a lecturer's salary because they're casualized.
You can't plan where you're going to live, you can't plan having a family, you never know exactly how long you're going to be employed, so you can't plan anything.
The average undergraduate degree costs around $35,000 in tuition fees. That's excluding books, travel, and accommodation. Students from outside the UK pay double or more.
If you're a teacher, one of your tasks is to steer your pupils into a job, to tell them that at the end of the day, education pays off, that it has societal value. But the reality is that some of the brightest minds in Britain are struggling to make a living.
Compare that with the average vice chancellor's pay, which is 6.5 times greater than the average staff member's. This is the latest in a wave of escalating industrial action taking place across the UK. Workers in several other sectors, such as the postal service, transportation, and health, also walking out for a similar reason. Negotiations between university staff and management are ongoing. Meanwhile, frustration among academics is growing that universities are putting profit before people. Saeed Purza, London.
A recent Afghanistan welfare monitoring survey by the World Bank is sounding the alarm bell about the devastating living conditions of Afghan people. People are struggling to put food on the table while lacking access to many other simple necessities. Almost half the population has reported a constant decrease in monthly earnings.
We are facing many difficulties, especially in recent weeks. We slid into a bad recession. I work from dawn to dark, selling potatoes and onions. But so far, I haven't even made a penny to buy some loaves of bread for my 6 children. Our house is cold and I have not bought fuel. I am concerned about the health of my children.
The survey has also found a rise in unemployment rates across the country. More and more Afghans are finding it difficult to land a job. The situation is only expected to get worse during the coming winter months. World Bank officials have called on Taliban rulers to take action on improving the living conditions of Afghan people. The Taliban says it does have plans, but needs access to the Afghan assets frozen by Washington in order to make them work.
With regards to addressing people's livelihoods and poverty, I confess there have been problems, and the major reason for the economic crisis and deprivation of Afghans is that their assets are crucially frozen. Furthermore, Afghanistan is practically sanctioned. Those who were defeated in Afghanistan use sanctions as tools for advancing their foreign diplomacy, but we are trying to neutralize the effects of sanctions and move Afghanistan to gradually become stable and self-sufficient.
The U.S. withdrew its forces from Afghanistan in 2021, but that has not stopped American politicians from asserting pressure on Afghan people. The war-torn country has not yet got the chance to repair the damage caused by more than two decades of Western aggression. As the winter comes closer, more and more Afghans are struggling. People here believe urgent support from the international community can be a lifeline for millions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The EU is currently paying more for gas than any other region in the world. The European Commission had proposed to cap natural gas prices at €275 per megawatt hour. The idea was totally rubbished by the bloc's energy ministers at a meeting on Thursday.
A ceiling between €150 and €200 is a realistic ceiling, and this could help us reduce gas prices and therefore reduce electricity prices.
But any sort of a cap could result in gas suppliers moving their tankers to other parts of the world where there is no cap, like Asia.
If we really see that this mechanism is designed in the way that that we will lose LNG cargoes to other international markets, then we can suspend it.
As things stand in the EU, there is no guarantee of a manageable gas price or even a gas supply for 2023.
If we cannot keep our economy running, we will not be able to support Ukraine, and we must do everything to avoid such scenario.
Those representing small to medium-sized businesses are looking for EU support amid high inflation and growing interest rates.
If we not want to fight unemployment and youth unemployment, we need to take care about the growth and competitiveness of European SMEs.
A debate in the European Parliament this week on promoting stability in the Middle East heard that the initiative would help ensure energy security for the EU. However, one lawmaker raised the West's previous actions in the region.
Leaving broken countries, hobbled economies, violence, trauma and permanent conflict. And at the end of that, we stroke our chins, pretend we've nothing to do about it and ask how we are going to promote stability in the region. You have got to be joking.
EU energy ministers will meet again on the 13th of December to try and reach agreement on the vital question of 2023 gas supplies. Analysts say this crisis best illustrates how sanctions against Russia have backfired. Jerome Hughes, Brussels. The recent decision by Italy to close its ports to the Ocean Viking vessel carrying 234 refugees has been slated in the European Parliament. The vessel, operated by a charity, was eventually allowed to dock in France.
How cynical is it that NGOs filling this gap and saving lives are criminalised, whereas the states violating their obligation enjoy impunity?
Asylum applications have increased by 60% in the EU during the past 12 months. That figure is separate from those arriving from Ukraine. In fact, the 27 EU nations are providing maximum support to Ukrainians, while those from other countries are often forced to sleep on the streets.
How dare so many of you define yourself as Christians and repeat that you are defending Christian values when your ideas and your actions are proof of the opposite.
In the Mediterranean alone, 2,000 refugees have drowned so far this year, according to the International Organization for Migration. The message seems to be, if you're not one of the 4 million Ukrainians who have arrived in the EU in recent months, you're not welcome. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. Apparently, the far right is flourishing in the EU due to the bloc's neglect of refugees.
How did Lega get big? How did the AfD get big? How did Marine Le Pen get big? It's all by capitalising on the fears of migration.
The ascent of the extreme right in the EU is certainly bad news for asylum seekers, according to analysts.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
EU Home Affairs ministers will hold an emergency meeting on the refugee crisis this Friday. There's a great deal of scepticism that anything will be achieved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Deal or no deal? While the EU is still reluctant to lay its negotiating cards on the table, at a press conference in the capital, Tehran, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian stressed that Iran's negotiating team is ready for the next round of talks and is waiting for the bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, to set a date for ministerial-level negotiations.
We have made our stance clear, and in the previous negotiations, we communicated our views regarding the remaining issues. Last week, we announced that we are ready for the next round of talks, and now Mr. Borrell is following up and trying to set a date. Obviously, talk will continue if we make sure that our logical demands are met.
In the words of Hossein Amir Abdollahian, resolving the remaining issues with the IAEA, receiving guarantees on the economic benefits of the deal for Iran, and removing unilateral sanctions are the three key issues that need to be worked out.
The JCPOA revival talks are high on the agenda, and we are adamantly following up on the issue. Of course, this will happen when we make sure that our reasonable demands in line with our national interests are met.
According to the top diplomat, Iran and the U.S. continue to exchange messages. However, American officials take what Amir Abdollahian calls a hypocritical stance while talking to mainstream media by making comments that contradict the messages that they send to Iran.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has always deviated from its technical path and taken a political stance. European and American negotiators had promised that this would not happen again, but they broke their promise yet another time.
These comments come after a recent anti-Iran resolution passed by the IAEA Board of Governors prompted the Islamic Republic to announce that it will begin 60% uranium enrichment in its Fordo nuclear facility. Over the past couple of years, Iran has demonstrated in practice that it is committed to the JCPOA, or the nuclear deal. It has always been the other side that has neglected the agreement. Now, Iran says for these negotiations to reach a final conclusion, it is necessary for the other side to offer some guarantees that it will remain committed to any agreement that is reached. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
On Tuesday, Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni unveiled Italy's 2023 draft budget bill during a press conference held at the government building. The package features a $35 billion spending plan and fiscal policies focusing mainly on supporting families, self-employed workers and those on low incomes.
Due grandi priorità.
There are two big priorities: growth, which means safeguarding our production system, and social justice, which means focusing on families and on people on low incomes. This budget is the product of political choices, as is normal for a political government.
About two-thirds of the 35 billion euro budget bill will be allocated to measures aimed at helping struggling families and businesses with the cost of living emergency. Power bills have skyrocketed amid the energy crisis sparked by the Ukraine war, while Italy's annual inflation rate was almost 12% in October, the highest level since March 1984.
Buying food, fuel, paying power bills, it's very difficult. We are struggling to make ends meet, and we expect this government to help us.
The government must ease tax pressure. We can't go on this way anymore. And the war in Ukraine should be stopped. All problems began with the conflict.
A flat tax rate on incomes of up to 85,000 euros for professionals and individual businesses is to be introduced, while the controversial citizenship wage basic income introduced by the Five Star Movement in 2018 is set to be reduced. Also, the pension system will be reformed to allow early retirement. The cabinet also discussed the 2013 Euratom directive, which deals with civilians being exposed to ionizing radiations. Euratom is the European Atomic Energy Community, which was set up in the late 50s to shape Europe's nuclear energy market. The draft budget bill will now be sent to Brussels for approval before it is passed. Max Civili, Rome.
People have gathered to receive winter fuel in form of coal and wood distributed by Iranian embassy in Kabul to warm the cold days of their lives. Najiba and Tahira, who take care of their children all alone, cry out the problems of the cold winter.
I don't have a supporter and my husband has passed away. It's five of us in my family, all of whom are jobless. Currently, we live in a rental house. We could really use such aids and hope it continues, especially in winters.
It is a hard winter, especially for us who don't have the primary needs of our lives. I have small children. I literally don't have anything to warm my home. I work hard to feed my seven family members, but still can't meet our needs.
Almost all who receive relief aids are widows and orphans, most of whom burn plastic, tires, and other waste materials to warm their houses and sometimes cook food. The happiness is noticeable as these widows can provide a warm home for their orphans. The number of these families can reach up to 1,000.
Well, we are prepared to distribute fuel to 1,000 families. The fuel is firewood and coal. We give each family a package of almost 200 kilograms. It isn't much, but it could be enough for almost a month. We are hoping to be able to continue such activities in the coming months also.
With the arrival of winter, concerns about the situation of the people of Afghanistan have intensified. The arrival of winter and warming houses has added to the daily problems of the poor in Afghanistan. Although aid is being provided to some people, there are still many who spend their nights in cold weather. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
Four members of an Italian neo-Nazi organization known as the Order of Hagal were arrested on Tuesday in the cities of Naples, Caserta and Avellino, about 200 kilometers south of Rome. At different phases within the process of the investigation, the police collected numerous Nazi and fascist propaganda material, bullets, weapons, tactical clothing and other elements that convinced Italy's judiciary to make charges against members of the Order of Hagal.
The police investigation was launched in 2019 when authorities suspected neo-Nazi groups were plotting violent acts in Italy. Today, members of the neo-Nazi organization, the Order of Hagal, have been accused of planning to carry out terrorist attacks on civilian and police targets.
Investigative activity showed that the neo-Nazi organization placed in Italy and Nazi-Ukrainian military groups, such as the Azov Battalion, Misanthropic Division and Centuria, have been in contact to conduct paramilitary training. In fact, diplomas were given for completing the training.
The Azov Battalion is a neo-Nazi paramilitary group that has been incorporated into the Ukrainian National Guard and is currently fighting against Russian troops. The Order of Hagal is an organization based in the area surrounding Naples. Authorities, however, suspect that the group may have subdivisions across Italy. The Order of Hagal has established operational ties to the Azov Battalion. Besides Nazism and anti-Semitism, it promotes subversion and white supremacy culture.
Some of the neo-Nazis' organization's members were trained in Ukrainian camps with the purpose of conducting the military operations in Italy. The group was recruiting among disadvantaged Italians, often young people, people who have a negative, incomplete view of society and can be easily manipulated. The Order of Hagal maintains direct and frequent contacts with its members over Telegram.
An additional member of the neo-Nazi Order of Hagal organization remains wanted by the Italian police, but is currently fighting Russian forces alongside the Azov Battalion. Not long ago, a high-ranking officer from the International Criminal Police Organization, Interpol, warned that the high availability of weapons during the current conflict in Ukraine will result in the proliferation of illicit arms in the post-conflict phase. Max Civili, Rome.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the heart